Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Pretty amazing weekend, right? Hell of a weekend, wasn't it? All four playoff games decided by 8 points or less. Two of them went to overtime. Now, I know this, and let's not get it twisted. I'm not saying that they were the best played football games ever, nor were they four of the highest scoring games ever, but there were some really strong moments. Damn strong moments. Houston coming back from down double digits to win in overtime. Tennessee out-patrioting the Patriots. The Eagles being banged up. I mean, banged up to hell and still battling their asses off. And then you have Kirk Cousins and the Minnesota Vikings. Now, before I get into this, let me say a couple of things. Number one, Saints fans, I feel for you. For the last 3 years, you have either been jammed by the refs or had your heart ripped out by an opponent. And in this case yesterday, both of those things happened. I mean, Kyle Rudolph pretty much did get away with a push-off on that game-winning TD. He just did. Well, it obviously was not as blatant as that non-call in the conference title game last year against the Rams. To me, that was OPI. That was offensive pass interference. I mean, the guy did extend his arm, and he was able to get separation by extending his arm. That, by very definition, is pass interference, and it should have been called. That's why they put in the new rule this year, to prevent that very thing from happening on that very stage. And it happened again. And it happened to the Saints again. However, that said, that's not the reason you lost, Saints fan. But after what you've endured the past 3 years, I would imagine you do feel that way. Except me, I am more focused, way more focused on what the Vikings did to you as opposed to what the referees did to you. And here's the other thing. If you want to come in here and reset some tired old drop that Kirk Cousins said years ago when he was playing for another team, do not bother. It's been beaten into the ground. You like that? Resets are about as fresh as "Are you not entertained?" resets. And that's from a movie that came out like 20 years ago. We've had nearly two decades of that reset. And it's uninspired. It's unoriginal. It's tired. It's played. It's lazy. I'm not having it. Not on my show. Unless it is from the man himself. So what I'm saying is, I'll lift my ban on "you like that" resets, but only for one man. And one man only, and that, of course, is Cousins himself in the locker room after the game yesterday.
"That's how we've won all year, team, right? Yes, you held them to 20 points, man. Yes, you gave us a chance at the end, but I got three words for you. You like that?" Yes!
All right, so that guy right there can reset that line. He can, you can't. Because you didn't do this, he did.
Third and goal from the 4. Kirk takes the snap, looks right, fade left, end zone, and it is caught! Touchdown!
He knew he had Rudolph one-on-one with the corner.
Rudy!
And just threw the jump ball. Oh, what a beautiful throw.
Vikings radio on the call. And before Cousins did that, just as impressively, if not more so, he did this.
Madison, the tailback, play action for Kirk from under center, straight drop. Kirk trying to win it to Thielen, caught at the 5, and he stopped at the 2. Cousins, Thielen, 42 on the Saints. First and goal, Vikings from the 2.
That pass to Adam Thielen was perfect. In fact, I'm not sure what was better, the pass or the catch. And to do it on the road in overtime was insane. The very definition of clutch. And it was redemption. Not just for Cousins, which I'll get to in a minute, but for Thielen. He spotted the Saints 3 points with that fumble on the opening possession. But he bounced back. And he was able to bounce back because of a technique he learned in college. Thielen said, quote, "Just flush that play away. It's actually something from college. Our coaches used to make us do. Flush the bad play. We actually had a little mini toilet on the sideline, and we'd have to go over and flush it. So that's where that came from." End quote. Like, remember Miami had the turnover chain, and Minnesota State Mankato had the mini toilet. And that fumble was not the only thing that went down the drain yesterday. Because not that Cousins would be looking to do it, but he could be ramming a nice Crow Sando down everybody's throat right now if he wanted to. Instead of, you like that?
You like that?
He could be screaming from the rooftops, how you like me now? Or better yet, tell me how my ass tastes.
Tell me how my ass tastes.
But he's not. He's just not, because that's not how he rolls. That's never been how he rolled. He's taken heat for years, even earlier this year, and he just kept on rolling. Hell, remember, it was only September of this year that he was getting absolutely killed for how he was playing, and then he completely turned it around, both his season and Minnesota's, for everybody who ever took a run at him for not winning on the road, against good teams, in pressure situations. Hell, even the comment from Thielen himself earlier in the year that, quote, you have to be able to hit the deep balls, end quote. Remember that? Thielen said that about him earlier this year. So Cousins took all of that on in that one play. He saw Patrick Robinson on Thielen in man coverage, and he hit that deep ball. He probably has never thrown a better ball in his career, and he did it at the best time possible, and then he did it again. Because after Dalvin Cook was stopped on two straight runs, that ball was in Cousins' hands on third down from the four-yard line facing a zero blitz. Alvin, if you don't mind, roll it again.
Kirk takes the snap, looks right, fade left, end zone, and it is caught! Touchdown!
Yes, Saints fans, it certainly did look like offensive pass interference. And not only was there no flag on that play, but it was reviewed so quickly, many of the Saints themselves, in fact, thought that the officials didn't even bother to review it. But it was, and it was league senior VP of officiating, Al Riveron, who was there with an explanation after the game. Quote, there is contact by both players, but none of that contact rises to the level of a foul. This is consistent with what we've done all year long. We left the ruling on the field. We let it stand. End quote. So yes, the Saints are getting jammed again. I would say the breaks all even out, but they sure don't seem to with the Saints, right? Last year against the Rams, this year with Rudolph. And there was that blatant hold in overtime and the fumble return. It was taken off the board, even though that should have been taken off the board, but it still hurts. In fact, it all does, because this Saints team had everything you need to make a Super Bowl run, and they didn't even get out of the first weekend. Man, that's got to hurt like hell. And the Saints know it, because hearing the players after the game, it seemed like the thing that pissed them off the most was not the lack of pass interference. Not even the whack overtime rules that means if you give up a TD on the opening drive of overtime, that game is over without both teams getting to touch the ball. Nope. The Saints were pissed that they did not play their best game when it was needed, that the Vikings did not get their best shot, that they didn't play their best when they had to, but the Vikings did. I mean, one thing before I go to break, keep this in mind. That was a Vikings team that nobody was giving any chance to. An 8-point underdog who fumbled away the first possession of the game. They were down 10-3 in the second quarter. Most thought they were done. The narrative had already been etched in stone that Kirk Cousins could not get it done on the big stage. That Mike Zimmer, with a one and done, might even be on the way out. Turns out they didn't get that memo because they turned it on and they scored 17 unanswered. Dalvin Cook looked especially sharp and fresh, especially in that first half. The Vikings D-line was causing Drew Brees serious problems. And when it mattered most, it was the most maligned quarterback who stepped up with a bomb and then a walk-off TD, not the Hall of Famer. And yes, everyone in purple likes that. Cousins had to have it. He got it. And that was an enormous statement for both him and the organization. And to me, that one's going to stick to the Saints for a long time. Because again, all the pieces were in place for a Super Bowl run. And now it's over before it even started. And they can kill the officials all they want. But when they look in the mirror this morning, if they own it, they'll know the Vikings did not get their best shot. And that more than anything else, that's the reason the Saints lost, not the refs.
I got three words for you. You like that?
Yeah!
All right, then, let's talk for a moment about a common problem. The one thing that health experts, dietitians, athletes, and top performers all seem to agree upon is the perfect diet simply does not exist. Even with a balanced, healthy diet, it can be so hard to cover all your nutritional bases through food alone. This is why there is Athletic Greens. The Athletic Greens Ultimate Daily All-in-One Health Drink has 75 proven vitamins, minerals, and whole food source ingredients, which make it easier for you to get the comprehensive nutrition without the need for a bunch of pills, powders, and complex routines. One scoop of Athletic Greens provides a convenient, affordable, and tasty solution to fill those gaps in your diet. So, if you're looking to boost energy, strengthen your immune system, or support gut health, this is the product for you. Whether you're taking steps towards a healthier lifestyle or you're an athlete pushing for better performance, Athletic Greens takes the guesswork out of everyday good health. Why not just try it? Jump on over to athleticgreens.com/Rome. Get my special offer right now. 20 free travel packs valued at $79 with your first purchase. AthleticGreens.com/Rome. Talking to Ross Tucker. All right, so you were in Philadelphia last night on the sideline for the Seahawks-Eagles. What did you make? Why don't we start right there? What did you make of Seattle and the way they showed up on the road and they handled their business?
Well, Russell Wilson is remarkable. And I said this for a while now, Jim, and I wrote about it in a column a couple weeks ago. I think he is basically the NFL prototype at this point, which is crazy when you consider that he was the outlier in the 2012 draft, and that's why he didn't go until the third round. But you look at everything he has done on and off the field since then. He's never missed a game. Some of the throws and plays he made last night, again, absolutely remarkable. The way he conducts himself, it's crazy. Now, look, I'm not saying it'd be a bad thing if he was 3 inches taller or whatever, but I just think he's the best quarterback in the NFL, and if I could only have one quarterback for the next 5 to 10 years, it's him. I mean, he is – I don't think they have a ton around him, Jim. I really don't. I think it's primarily him, and because of him, they have a chance in every game they play in.
We're talking to Ross Tucker. Ross, I don't disagree with any of that. I wonder if he were 3 inches taller, if he'd be that much better or not. I mean, based on the way he approaches it, his mentality, that chip on the shoulder, I'm not sure he would be, but I understand your point. Listen, you've been around this Eagles team all season long. They've been battling injuries like crazy, and it happened again, Ross, last night when Carson Wentz went out after that hit to the head. What went through your mind when you saw him heading to the locker room?
Well, it was weird because I was on the Seahawks sideline when he got hit. So I did not know he was hurt until he started walking into the locker room. And I saw that and I sprinted over there to find out what was going on. And then they had told me, you know, that he had kind of gotten up slow after the hit from Clowney. And I think I had two thoughts, Jim, you know, doing the preseason games for the Eagles and the Eagles pregame all year. You know, I know him pretty well. I really felt bad for him. I mean, the whole conversation all offseason was whether or not he could stay healthy. And he did it all year, played his best football over the last month of the season, was able to bring what I was calling the practice squad posse or the Broad Street backups all the way to the playoffs. It was remarkable. And I wanted him to have this opportunity. I wanted him to show what he could do on that stage and not get hurt again and have that narrative of him getting hurt. So I felt really poorly for him, but I also kind of felt like we all got cheated. You know, Jim, like I left the game very dissatisfied, and the Seahawks might have won anyway. You never know how the game unfolds. I'm very confident the Eagles would have scored more points because Wentz was so good in the red zone all year that there's no way they settled for 3 field goals and on 2 fourth downs. They don't get it. They would have scored more points. And maybe the Seahawks maybe win, but I think we all kind of got gypped out of being able to see what Wentz and this team of practice squad guys could do in the playoffs. It left a bad taste in my mouth, and not necessarily because of the Clowney hit, as much as just not being able to see what Wentz was going to be able to get done.
Ross Tucker back in the jungle doing his thing. Hey, Ross, what about that hit? Jadeveon Clowney said after the game that he might get death threats for the hit on Wentz. Also said the people who come to Eagles games, Ross, are, quote, the worst fans in the world, end quote. What's your reaction to that comment?
Well, first of all, the hit itself, I thought it should have been penalized. I don't go so far as to say dirty or cheap shot. I mean, you know, Jim, we've talked about this before. I played on the edge. I played very borderline. So I'm the last guy that's going to be saying something was dirty or a cheap shot. But I do think it deserved to be flagged. I mean, even if you're saying he's a runner, they typically still afford quarterbacks more protection. I don't know how you don't throw a flag for that. But the point I would make on that is, okay, you throw the flag. I mean, it's not bringing Wentz back. No, it's not like it changes the game. Wentz staying in the game changes the game, but adding 15 yards to Clowney does not. As for the death threats thing, I mean, evidently he's already got him, so I guess he was right in that regard. As for the worst fans, it's really very simple. If you are someone that I would say is foolish enough to wear opposing team gear in Philadelphia, it's probably not going to be that pleasant of an experience. I mean, I'm from Reading, Jim, which is an hour west of Philly. I played at Veterans Stadium as a rookie with the Redskins. I told my mom, my dad, my sister, my girlfriend, and my father-in-law, don't even think about wearing Redskins gear. Like, don't be stupid. And they knew better because they're all from there too. You don't do that. Is that the way it should be, Jim? Probably not. It's probably not a positive that that's how they treat people. But it's a fact, so don't wear that stuff. And I'll say this on the flip side, they are the best fans. They are extremists. If you're on the other team or you don't play hard or whatever and you're on one of their teams, they're probably the worst fans around. If they love you, if you're Brian Dawkins, if you're Zach Ertz, heck, me even just doing the preseason games, if they love you, there is no better place to be. They are both the best and the worst fans, depending on whether or not they like you or not.
Ross Tucker joining us back in the jungle. All right, Ross, let me keep it right there in the division. During the Eagles game, the Cowboys announced they're moving on from Jason Garrett. So what do you make of Jerry Jones timing that announcement for the middle of the Eagles game?
A little bizarre. You know, he has stated publicly many times that any publicity is good publicity. But what's even more bizarre to me, Jim, with the hiring of Mike McCarthy, is that it's pretty clear that he literally was holding on to Jason Garrett until he was sure he had somebody better. I mean, it was like, you know, you're in high school and, you know, you see this other girl and you like her and you kind of want to date her, but you don't want to dump your current girlfriend unless you know that other girl is going to like you. You know what I mean?
Sure. Right.
So that's exactly what Jerry Jones did. He didn't want to dump Garrett until he knew that McCarthy would like him and that he could start dating McCarthy. And as soon as McCarthy was like, okay, I'm in, he was like, all right, see you later, Jason Garrett. So the timing of it, let's put it this way. It's not exactly a classy way to go about it, whether you're me in high school or Jerry Jones trying to get an NFL head coach.
No, that's not classy at all, by the way. So, Ross, where do you come out? Is McCarthy better? How much better? How do you like that fit?
I like starting with the track record that he has of being a Super Bowl championship winning head coach and being a guy with sustained success. What concerns me, Jim, on the flip side is, I don't know how long he was in Green Bay, 13 years, 14 years. He had a top five quarterback the whole time. I mean, he had Brett Favre for a few years when Favre was still playing well. Then he had Aaron Rodgers the whole time. He had a top five quarterback the whole time and went to one Super Bowl. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's impressive or not. I'd say probably not. I'd say you should probably at least get to another Super Bowl in that stretch of having 13 years with a top five quarterback. Plus, it got bad at the end. And now look at him. I mean, the Packers without him are 13-3. Now, in fairness to him, when he was there, Ted Thompson was the GM, never signed anybody. Now, they lose McCarthy. They get a new GM in. They sign Za'Darius Smith and Preston Smith, who are out there killing dudes, and a big reason why the Packers are 13-3. So you can go both ways on this. I would say it's pretty hard to kill a hire when the guy starts with being able to say he's a Super Bowl winning head coach.
Talking to Ross Tucker for another moment or so, but to your point, Ross, I wonder if that's not enough considering where he was and who he had. But before I let you go, as a former teammate of Tom Brady's in New England, do you think that that final pass was his final pass as a Patriot? How do you think that plays out?
I do not think it was, But I think it comes entirely down to Bill Belichick. How much does Bill Belichick want Brady back? And how important is the contract to Bill Belichick? Look, he's not sentimental. He wants to move on. All the reports indicate he wasn't happy that he was more or less forced to trade Garoppolo. Does he give Kraft an ultimatum? Does he say, hey, look, Robert, I did this once, but I'm not paying Tom a 2 or 3 year deal worth $30 million a year. We can have our best chance for sustained success moving forward is Jarrett Stidham on a rookie contract and being able to build around him rather than paying Tom, who's not the guy he used to be. I know that everybody's saying it's up to Tom. I really don't think it is. I think it's up to Belichick. If Belichick says he wants Brady back and he's willing to pay him what he wants, I think Brady comes back. But if Brady feels disrespected and doesn't feel like Belichick really wants him back, or they try to lowball him on the contract again, I think Brady's going to say, you know what? I'm sick of it. All the discounts I gave you, and you guys are going to lowball me again, I'm out of here.
I can't help but wonder or think that is pretty much what's going to happen. Hey, Ross, one last thought. What were you thinking as Mike Vrabel went with the back-to-back penalties to eat time off the clock in the fourth quarter?
I was laughing because Vrabel and I were teammates in New England, and Belichick seemed so upset about it, so angry about it, yet that's exactly what Belichick would do if he were in that situation. My initial thought, Jim, was, I don't love that they're punting it here and giving it back to Brady rather than going for it. And then I thought, okay, I like the idea to shorten the game and take the time off the clock, but what if Brady marches for a field goal right here, and then you actually shorted yourself the chance and the time? Ultimately, it worked out, and I was mainly laughing because I know Vrabel and the way he is, and he loved nothing more, I can promise you, Jim, than being able to be in that locker room after the game and knowing that he out-Belichicked Belichick. He was laughing, he was having a beer, and he was having the time of his life.
And he should. How about them Cowboys?
Yeah!
I mean, seriously, how about them Dallas Cowboys? The team that missed the playoffs and spent all of last week making sure that they were the number one topic instead of the playoffs with their bizarre handling of showing an abundance of care and respect for Jason Garrett. How about them Cowboys? The only thing that would top that abundance of care and respect that they managed to overshadow the playoffs with would be if they announced a coaching decision during the weekend of the playoffs. But there's no way that Jerry Jones would do that. I mean, not even Jerry Jones, the ultimate look at me guy. Even Jera would not undermine the playoffs like that. No way that he'd piss off the entire league by violating the most unwritten rule ever, the most obvious unwritten rule ever, by distracting from the games themselves. I know this guy's the ultimate look at me guy, but he's got to be a team player. There's no way he would do something to undermine the entire weekend. No way that he would take all eyes off the playoffs. I mean, the games themselves, to make it about him, right? No way he would announce a move between games on a Saturday night or Sunday. And you're right, he wouldn't do that. No way he'd do that. He would not announce a coaching decision between games on Saturday night or Sunday. Oh, hell no. He's not that guy. No, but he would do it during a game. And not just any game, but one played by the Philadelphia Eagles. The very same team that knocked his team out of the playoffs. The division rival that has been more successful lately and actually has won a Super Bowl in this century. Damn straight he did. And it was a statement that read in part, quote, "We are extremely grateful to Jason Garrett for his more than 20 years of service to the Dallas Cowboys as a player, assistant coach, and head coach. His level of commitment, character, and dedication to this organization has been outstanding at every stage of his career. His tenure of leadership will be characterized by his ability to produce teams that always play with great effort, emotion, and passion, and he represented our organization with great pride, loyalty, and respect." End quote. That's incredible. Like, what's the best part of that? The idea that they let Garrett twist for a week, oh, but did so out of an abundance of care and respect for Garrett, or that they showed the abundance of care and respect by reportedly interviewing multiple candidates for his job while he still had a job. I mean, what's more caring than that? What's more respectful than that? Or that they announced the decision to move on from him right in the middle of a playoff game being played by their rivals. It's actually all of the above. I said it earlier. I'll say it again right now. How about them Cowboys? Yeah! That is so great. I mean, like, you knew that they knew that they were moving on from this guy the moment they did not go to the postseason. When they weren't going to the playoffs, he was not coming back as head coach. They knew it. We knew it. Hell, deep down, Red knew it. But they made this guy come back anyway. They made him come back, and they made him stick around, and then they started to do a job search. A search for his job while he still held that job. And then, when they had an entire week to make an announcement, they decided to make the announcement right in the middle of an Eagles playoff game. And you're going to tell me that's a coincidence. You're going to tell me that's just some kind of crazy coinkydink. Man, that is so petty. That is so salty. That is so Jera. So then the question immediately became, once you get beyond what a lack of class that displayed, I mean, to string that guy out the way they did, I mean, I can't help but wonder if they thought to themselves, hey, look, we know we're going to fire this guy. He knows it. Everybody knows it. But hey, you know what? Let's not do it on Black Monday. Let's string this thing out. Let's wait until the Eagles are playing. Then let's do it. Are you going to really tell me that never crossed his mind? That he wouldn't do something like that? Come on. So he did it, allegedly. So who is your next Cowboy head coach? Is it Matt Rhule? Is it Herb? Is it Lincoln Meyer, Lincoln Riley? Not Herb Meyer. With the Saints losing, would they kick the tires on Sean Payton one more time and see if they could finally convince him to come back to Big D? I mean, Cowboy fans had to be peaking, had to be thrilled with the possibilities. After years of being mired in this mediocrity, they finally got rid of the clapper. So who is going to be the guy to take the Cowboys to the next level? Who is going to be the guy to unleash all that alleged Super Bowl talent that Jared claims that he compiled on both sides of the ball? I mean, how great would it be? How great would it be to see Sean Payton back in town? How great would it be to see Herb rocking the star? Cowboy fans were getting all worked up. And then came a tweet from Jay Glazer this morning, which read in part, quote, "The Dallas Cowboys have agreed to terms with Mike McCarthy to be their new head coach. Announcement and press conference expected later this week," end quote. Mike McCarthy. Look, I'm not going to say that that deserves a full Price is Right fail horn, but it does not feel like the most inspired hire ever, does it? Not when there was all that buzz about them maybe getting an elite coach from college. Now you're getting a guy who was canned midway through the year in Green Bay after going 4-7-1, and that was after going 7-9 the year before. A guy who was last in the news for screaming down a high school basketball ref at his stepson's game. So after all the hype, all the buzz, all the speculation, that's the guy you end up with. Is that the guy who's going to get Cowboy fans fired up and hyped and excited? I mean, don't get me wrong. I understand why you might be wary of going with a college coach with no NFL head coaching experience. I get why you might not want to give up a ton of assets to get Sean Payton. And I do know that McCarthy went to the playoffs 8 straight years, which the Cowboys sure have not done in a long time. And yes, he does have a ring. He does have a ring. But he also had Aaron Rodgers. And honestly, having Aaron Rodgers in only one Super Bowl might be more of a criticism than a celebration or a compliment. In other words, this is not a hiring that you immediately start to party about. You've got to think it through, right? You've got to convince yourself that it's actually a good thing. Much less a great thing. Because while it's not a disaster, it's not exactly a home run either. What they're getting is a guy who's got a lot of experience as an NFL head coach. A guy who comes from an offensive background. And there's a decent chance that, unlike Meyer or Peyton or another elite name, he's not going to demand to call all the shots. In other words, he will play some ball with Jarrah. And that's key because apparently that's the guy Jarrah wanted. Adam Schefter tweeted, new Cowboys head coach Mike McCarthy stayed over at Jerry Jones's house on Saturday night per source. Once you stay at Jerry's house, he doesn't lose his guy, said the source. End quote. Yeah, all right. Is it just me or how weird is that? The kooky billionaire owner having sleepovers. I mean, that's just weird, right? So not only was Jerry having sleepovers, but Jerry was interviewing two candidates for Jason Garrett's job while Jason Garrett still had a job. This is the way you show comparison or compassion and care, an abundance of care and compassion for a guy who was with you 20 years, by interviewing other dudes for his job while he still has a job. Jerry and Mikey are having a sleepover while Red still had a job. Man, that's weird. And not just Jarrah weird, but next level Jarrah weird and supremely awkward.
Awkward.
Let's go ahead and let a guy that we say that we care so much about and we respect so much, let's let that guy twist for a week and make him look like a dope while having a sleepover with his replacement, and then announce Garrett's replacement barely half a day after announcing his firing, after letting him sleep over. I wonder how many sleepovers Jarrah had with Jason over the years. What do these dudes do on those sleepovers? I don't know. Like, I've seen sleepovers for, like, teenage kids. But I've never seen them for, like, old and middle-aged dudes and people. Like, what do you do at a sleepover? Are those dudes just Snapchatting? Are they looking at their phones? Are they playing Fortnite? Are they in their sleeping bags? Are they going to the liquor cabinet and filling up the liquor bottles with water where there used to be liquor? Like, what are they doing? Are they getting baked? Are they getting ripped on bong hits? Yeah, that got your attention, didn't it, Hawk? Stoner. Look, if you're in the league office and Jerry ripped the thunder of the playoff game during the game, the only thing that could make it worse now would be if he stole the attention from the entire weekend with a report about hiring a new coach. And he did just that. The league would have loved a day or two talking about those four games, and now it's all about the Cowboys. Of course, Jerry's absolutely killing the game. Literally. He's killing the coverage and buzz about playoff games by making it about himself and his coaching search. And even worse, killing the buzz about his coaching search with the announcement. Let's not lose track of that. We just lost that. I mean, now they've got a coach. What the hell are we supposed to talk about? What are we supposed to do now that Red is no longer twisting? Yeah, as always, Jarrah, thanks. Thanks for nothing.
How about them Cowboys? Yeah!
Clones, let me talk to you about Root Insurance. Hey, listen, what if good drivers did not have to pay for bad drivers? Root Insurance thinks that the old way of pricing car insurance is not fair. So Root developed a mobile app which measures driving behavior. By removing bad drivers from the equation, Root saved good drivers up to 52% in 2019. So gone are the days where your car insurance rate is based on your credit score, your age, your gender, or your zip code. With Root, it's car insurance made easy. Using an app to base rates primarily on how you drive, better drivers deserve better rates. That's why the Root app uses driving behavior as the primary factor to determine car insurance rates. And in 2019, Root was the fastest growing direct insurance company in the United States. All you have to do, clones, is download the Root Insurance app. Drive normally for a few weeks during the Root test drive and then see how much you can save. Don't wait. Give Root a try. Head to your app store, download the Root Insurance app, and sign up in less than a minute to start your test drive right now. That's R-O-O-T. Again, download the Root app today or visit joinroot.com and learn more and see how much money you can save. It's not available in all states. Disclaimers may apply. See joinroot.com for details. Gene Steratore is my guest. Gene, it's good to have you in the jungle. How are you?
Jim, it's great to hear from you, and it's great to be on. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Gene. Great to hear your voice. All right, so we could talk about a lot of things, but let me start right here. There's been a lot of talk about Kyle Rudolph extending his arm on that touchdown in overtime that beat the Saints. Gene, as an official, what are the things that you're looking for, both in live action and on replay, to initiate a call of offensive pass interference?
What the word you just used, Jim, is the most important word when we break this down, and that is extends. Listen, these plays, we all know these plays, they happen so quick. And because of the quickness, and let's face it, many times defensive backs and receivers are engaged in some type of contact, hand fighting. So you look for indicators when you're a covering official. And in this situation, when the D-back is starting to come in to close to Rudolph's body, what you see is Rudolph's arm bent. So when he does then extend that arm to a full posting feel, he creates that separation from a bent arm to a full post. Had Rudolph's arm been extended and locked out prior to that D-back getting to him, then that indicator shows the official, look, that receiver, Rudolph, had claimed that space early enough so that contact doesn't become then maybe as significant to becoming a foul. But because the arm is bent and then he extends that, creating that separation, in my opinion, that's when that now rises to what would be offensive pass interference.
We're talking to Gene Steratore. All right, so Gene, was the decision then to allow review of pass interference calls, which are judgment calls, is that a good decision in your mind? Do you like that?
It's a difficult decision for me, Jim. And just as the catch was, which I was really so personally involved with as well, the only other truly subjective play to review, that is where I think we start to get in a different place with replay involved because of the subjectivity, the levels of what we all can look at certain plays and truthfully have a pretty good point either way. And I think that's when the NFL put this in. What they also did, and we have to remember what they did, was they didn't say we're going to review pass interference, but we're going to review a standard to which they would then apply to either remove a foul or create one. And I think that probably, as the year went on, became what we were all, no pun intended, challenged with as the season went on, because we were all looking for some type of boundaries. And I'm sure the coaches were, because, look, to throw a red flag out there on a hit-and-miss play is a big deal in the NFL, regardless of what time of the game that occurs, because timeouts are involved in those types of challenges. And I do think that's where the frustration and most of the questions have arisen as the season went on and now into the postseason as well.
Gene Steratore is joining us. You know, Gene, not to spend too much time on this one topic, but finally, how do you go about then distinguishing between allowable hand fighting and pass interference?
That's the art of officiating, Jim. I mean, it's no different in how much restriction is a hold and how much isn't, and is it at the point of attack and those different levels. Look, that's what officials are doing on every 4 to 5 second play that occurs 150 plus times a day. That is the craft and that subjectivity and the ability then that once you do initiate fouls on those certain plays, the next real hurdle to get through as a crew, game by game, as a league, week by week, is let's try to maintain some consistency on what does constitute that in live action. And that is that's why I love doing what I did when I officiated. It was that challenge every night, be it football or basketball, to apply that in a consistent manner and hope that everyone else involved in the game on that certain day was doing it in that same area. And that's when you have a well-officiated game. Sometimes there's a little more hands in a game. Sometimes it's tighter. And teams or coaches never were upset, depending on how you were going to do it. Just keep it that way for the day. Consistency was always the most important word on the field and or court every night.
Gene Steratore is a rules analyst for CBS Sports Now. So, Gene, as a rules analyst, what did you make of Mike Vrabel taking 3 straight penalties in the fourth quarter to eat up the clock?
You know, you've got to give kudos to Coach Vrabel. Coach Belichick did it during the regular season against the Jets. It was a game that I was covering from the studio as well. It is a loophole in the rule. And I believe that Coach Vrabel either had thought that on his own, or in most cases in the NFL, when something happens where someone has applied a loophole, Most guys are taking notes on those types of plays, and the irony was that the loop that he may have seen during the regular season, he actually applied here last weekend in New England. And I do see them moving forward and adjusting this a little, Jim, because when you think about fouls that prevent the snap, there really are three different scenarios by an offensive team where they can create a foul before the snap without having the official think after the second one that something nefarious is happening or unsporting is occurring. You could have a false start. Then you could have a delay of game. And then you could have 12 men in the huddle. All of them three different fouls that prevent the snap. And at no time as a referee would I feel comfortable, if those happened in those sequences, to go to that coach and say, look, you're doing something unsporting right now. This isn't good for the game. There's not a good comeback from that I could hear from a coach. He could get upset with me, rightly so, that I were implying something that doesn't exist. I think moving forward, the NFL definitely will look at this. And really, in the quick take on this from my end, look, if there are two fouls consecutively by an offense that prevent the snap, I think it makes it a cut-and-dry situation to say that the next play will start on the snap and we will not wind and lose any more time after that. And I think there will be definite discussion regarding that play and that scenario as we move forward.
Gene Steratore breaking it all down. Now, Gene, speaking of a coach being upset, Bill Belichick was yelling at the officials during that sequence, getting really salty with his language. As a referee in that situation, how do you deal with that? Like, are you trying to explain things to him, or are you just going to let him rant?
You know what, Jim? I think of all things that I have missed here, and I being on the field or on the court, I think it are those exchanges which you kind of, in your own way, enjoy because of the intensity and the magnitude of those conversations. And I think a good referee and a good practice in managing that scenario and handling those emotions is that you allow the coach to vent and get it all out and take it all in as a referee in a calm, confident way, absorbing whatever he is saying to you and then allowing him to finish and then hopefully presenting something back to him which makes enough sense that we can move on from that play or that scenario once we're finished with that little conversation. I always wanted the coach to go first, though, Jim, and get everything out and kind of prefaced it that way. Like, I want you to speak, but when you're finished, you're finished now, then I get to respond, right? Yeah, and then once I responded, usually they try to answer back, and you could always kindly remind them that we had an agreement before this started that you got to talk first and I got to finish. So I do miss those moments, though. I won't lie to you, Jim.
Gene, I love that you miss those moments, and since you said that you missed those moments, like, what was the finest moment you had in that regard? Like, what's the fiercest exchange you ever had on the field with a coach, and who was it with?
You know what? There are just so many. And the back and forths in basketball were fantastic because of the proximity. Football is a little different because you're in the middle of a field as a referee and you really don't get over there until a TV timeout or a downtime, things of that nature. But my goodness, I'll tell you what, if you bring me back, I'll have a handful of them, Jim, and we could do a good 10 minutes just on those back and forths. I would love to do that.
That's how you set that up, and I will bring you back for that. Gene Steratore joining us. You know, Gene, you mentioned last month that Lamar Jackson is the closest thing you've seen to Michael Vick, and you had reffed his 1999 Virginia Tech debut. What do you remember about that game?
I remember that, as I remember, probably 20 plays in my career, something in that area where you actually went from being an active participant to being a spectator for the brief second because something just unbelievably occurred in front of you. And, you know, I remember a young Michael Vick who was it was his first start, as you had mentioned, and then playing James Madison, which is a 1AA, you know, powerhouse matchup early in the year. And this young quarterback scrambled to his right, and I remember as I was chasing him that this D-back was coming in with his head down and not head up and was trying to get low, and then just to watch him leave his feet in a way that you just don't see too often, especially in college football, and then do a front flip and almost landed it. And then I remember Coach Beamer running out onto the field, Jim, and as Michael Vick was laying in the end zone, he looked at him and he said, "Don't ever try that again,"
right,
with this awe. He was in shock, as we all were. And then the smile that followed that from Coach Beamer after he said that as he walked back to the sideline is a memory I will never forget.
Gene Steratore is my guest for a few more moments. Gene, I mentioned that you were the referee for Super Bowl 52. You have worked conference championship games in the NFL, NCAA tournament games in basketball. What's it like for you as you prepare to work an enormous game knowing that all eyes are going to be on you?
It's the calmness of understanding what you're about to undertake. It's the pressure. It's all of the things that you possibly could imagine, and there is a sense of calmness that is very difficult in your regular life to replicate. And then the beauty of the whole thing of it, Jim, I think more than anything, and this is happening now as an analyst too, which I really enjoy, and that is, you know, what makes sports so wonderful for all of us is that it is unscripted. You know, the ball bounces in a funny way. Things happen in a split-second moment that you can never prepare for. So you really have only your skills and all of the things that had brought you to that point to take you into a completely unscripted environment that is full of emotion and intensity and pressure. And you have two choices. You either embrace that or it consumes you. And I think that calmness, knowing what you're about to undertake is again, I think that's why these athletes play well into some years where we look and go, why would he come back after his fourth surgery? Why does he want to do this? He's got enough money to live the rest of his life. He has all these human things, we say. And unless you have participated and done that at a level sometimes this high, you can't understand that until you have actually been blessed enough to participate in it. And those are the things that you remember. And you hope you never forget them, Jim.
He is an NFL, NCAA basketball, and a football rules analyst for CBS. Once again, 15 years as an NFL game official, 13 as a referee. He was the referee of Super Bowl 52, 22 years as a Division I basketball official. Hey, Gene, why don't we consider that part one, and I will bring you back for part two when it makes some sense and when it's convenient for you.
I'm in, Jim. You just let me know. I'm in whenever you want me.
You had the Seahawks playing an Eagles team that was decimated by injury, losing players by the minute, including Carson Wentz, who had a concussion, and they had to go with Josh McCown. Man, I got to say, McCown making his debut, postseason debut at age 40. This guy played his ass off. I mean, he said it himself, and it's true. He left it all on the field. Nothing but respect for him, the way he competed, the way he played, how badly he wanted it. But the Seahawks just had a little too much. They had too much. There was no way that a 40-year-old backup quarterback was going to come in and outplay or outduel Russ Wilson. Not that it was on McCown, but he just did not have enough around him, especially when DK Metcalf caught the dagger that ended it.
Cover zero. Here come the Eagles. And Wilson's going to go deep downfield, and you've got an open man in Metcalf to the 50-yard line. And that, in all likelihood, will write a finish to this one.
I'm laughing because I loved him at the end of that play. He got up and flashed the peace sign to everybody. Gave it to the entire stadium. Peace out. Nice knowing you. Ball game. See y'all in Green Bay. And why the hell did I drop to the second round? In the first game of the weekend, Bills Mafia. Man, I wish I had better news, but I don't. The way that first half went, it looked like your team was going to roll right into Houston, punch the Texans in the face, leave with a playoff win, and we were going to have a party all day long today. But something happened to the Texans in the second half. Their offense woke up. The defense started giving Josh Allen a lot of trouble. And then Josh Allen started to do some really wild things, both good and bad. As I mentioned earlier, the entire world was treated to the entire Josh Allen experience. And Houston wins. Then there was the other game on Saturday. You know, for all that talk that Saturday night might have been the end of a dynasty. Then it might have been Tom Brady's last game in Foxborough. I mean, it's amazing that it's taken this long, other than my conversation with Ross Tucker early on, this long for me to actually get to this and talk about it in any kind of detail during the program. The possible end of the greatest dynasty in NFL history, and it's getting overshadowed by Mike McCarthy. Now, in part because I'll believe it's the end when it actually is the end. I'll believe it's the end when Tom Brady announces his retirement or that he's coming to play for the Chargers or the Panthers or anybody else that might end up with him. I'll believe all of that when I see all of that. Now, if that really is the end, it is pretty fitting that they went down the way they did. Losing at home to Mike Vrabel and the Titans. And that they were out-patrioted by a former Patriot. Because as great as Derrick Henry was in that game, and Derrick Henry was great, 204 yards from scrimmage against the top-ranked defense in the NFL and left a collection of bodies and body parts in his wake. But as great as that guy was, as great as the Titans' goal line stand was, the best part of that game, the best part of that game was Mike Vrabel out-hooding the hood man with that clock-eating clinic of delay of game, false start, delay of game that took 96 seconds off the clock and sent Belichick into a rage on the sidelines.
Delay of game, offense, 5-yard penalty, fourth down.
He's only had two touchbacks the whole year.
Take a delay of game multiple times.
Offense, number 59, 5-yard penalty, fourth down. Which was under fraction.
Yeah.
Defense, number 29, 5-yard penalty, fourth down.
This is a chess game between these two. Gene, when you take multiple delay of games, there's a penalty eventually.
That's correct, Tony, and the penalty will turn into an unsportsmanlike conduct foul.
Belichick doesn't like it because if it was two delay of games, they can't do it again. But since he ran a false start on the second one, it's very Belichick-esque.
Right, exactly, which made it so awesome. The Hood Man is out here dropping F-bombs like crazy, which is incredible. This wasn't him kind of mumbling and muttering. My man was enunciating F-bombs. And wasn't it back in October that Belichick did the same thing? That Belichick, not uttering F-bombs, but seemed to be smirking on the sideline while he was doing the exact same thing to the Jets. And as he said after the game, it's a loophole. You know, that right there is just a loophole. It's a loophole that probably is open and should be closed. But what are you going to do? It's a loophole. I took advantage of a loophole. Yeah, he didn't seem to be talking about how that was Vrabel shit taking advantage of a loophole. He sure as hell didn't seem to like it when the tables were turned on him and somebody else was taking advantage of said loophole. But let's not get that twisted. Vrabel did not just take a book, or I should say a page, out of Belichick's book. He took Belichick's entire book, ripped it out of his hand, and then smashed him over the head with it. Because that sequence not only ate up the clock, it ended with a punt. The Titans led 14-13 in the fourth quarter on the road in Foxborough, and they decided to give the ball back to the Patriots' offense. Right? They had 4th and 5 from the Patriots' 36. Instead of keeping the ball and trying to get that first down and stretching the lead and keeping the ball away from the GOAT, they went into penalty mode. Then they punted. They said, we don't think that Tom Brady and that offense playing at home can score another point on our defense. We don't think that cruel receivers that you keep running out there, that keep putting the ball on the ground at the wrong time, can beat our guys. And they were right. I mean, it would have seemed like back in the day, like the most sacrilegious thing ever. Well, you're going to give the ball back to Tom Brady. Yes, we are. Because then they forced an immediate 3-and-out, and they got the ball back. And then they ate up nearly three more minutes, and then they punted again, which set up this unbelievable moment.
And Tom Brady, back in his own end zone, perhaps for one of the final times, takes the snap.
Oh!
As he throws underneath, passes broken up, intercepted, touchdown! Logan Ryan, off the deflection!
Sorry for the spoiler alert. The preemptive uh-oh. Like, I still can't believe that happened.
Uh-oh.
Imagine if that was Westwood 1. Imagine if that really was Tom Brady's final pass as a Patriot. Or better yet, final pass period. Either way, What a hideous way to go out. Throwing a pick six at home to ice the game for the opposing team after being insulted the way Vrabel and the Titans did to them with those punts in the fourth quarter. Like, literally, here's the ball. You can have it back. Don't give a damn. We know you're not going to do anything with it. And they didn't. Man, imagine that. But I'm here to hype the Titans and not crush the Patriots or talk about their soap operas. There'll be plenty of time for that. There'll be plenty of time for drama about whether Brady likes Belichick, whether Belichick likes Brady, whether Belichick really would do Brady the way he's done everybody else who came before him, whether or not Bob Kraft has the final say. How does Bob Kraft fit into this? Is it Kraft's call? Is it Belichick's call? Plenty of time for all that. I will say, for a team that is really disciplined, they also seem to embrace this kind of drama. So we'll get more of that than we want or than we need, and we'll get into all that a little further down the road. Right now, put some respect on the Tennessee Titans. That was not a fluke win. They were the better team. They knew it, and they played like it. They went into the place where it's so hard to win, and they took it to the Patriots and beat them in every possible way. They outplayed them. They outcoached them. They outclassed them. They outtoughed them. They outsmarted them. They outhooded them. And now they're moving on. And the Patriots are staying home. And the question is whether or not Tom Brady is going to stay or leave. Because this much you know, there's no way he's going out like that. He's not retiring on that. No way he ends that career on that pick six. No chance. Patriots season is over, and Chouts, that allegedly so-called historic Pats D that you said was so historic is not historic at all. I'm good. They're good, sure, but they're not historic. And as we've known all season long, old Tommy, he needed another weapon on the outside. Badly. I'm not even going to hammer you about that big lug Gronk or AB or Josh Gordon. But how about this? Hey, Hood, how about DK Metcalf? I don't know. Dude's got the look of a star that you sure as hell could have used Saturday and for the next decade. You could have had him. Hell, you'd be on to Kansas City. You'd be on to Kansas City. Mark Few is my guest. Mark, before we get into basketball, I got to know, how are you doing and how is life for you in 2020?
Life is great. Thanks for asking. Yeah, it's all good, man. Just like you, got the Christmas card. Your kids are, they're young men now, and it's the same kind of in our family. Everybody's growing up. We wish we could freeze them and keep them at the age they're at, but it doesn't happen that way. So we are living life, Marcy and I, and living great and just feel unbelievably blessed with everything going on.
So good to hear it, Mark. Appreciate that. Mark Few joining us. So you're coming off a win over Pepperdine, Mark, on Saturday night where Killian Tilly had 20 points, 4 rebounds, and 4 assists, and a block. I know you might not have been thrilled with the overall performance of the team necessarily, but what did you make of how he impacted the game both from an energy and a production standpoint?
Well, hey, Jim, Killian, he's an NBA player. And if he was healthy at the end of last year, or even at the end of his sophomore year, he would have been able to move up to that next level. He's just been kind of snake bit by a bunch of different injuries that have been a little bit fluky. But he's been battling some knee issues, and he's just such a courageous, tough kid because his knee isn't even close to 100%. But he's just such he impacts the game in just so many ways. He's got as good a feel for the game as any point guard I've ever had, which just makes him, really diabolical and dangerous, at the high post against zone defenses and popping up to the top of the key and kind of initiating our offense against man defense. He's finally getting kind of some extended run. We're getting him a little bit more run in these games, and I think he's really showing what he's capable of doing.
Again, Zaga head basketball coach Mark Few is joining us. So, Mark, coming into this season, four of your key players from last year had NBA contracts, and you were only returning one starter. As you said at that time, quote, "I don't know if we've ever been in this situation before. Usually we have a slight majority of experienced guys over newcomers," end quote. So it is different. How'd you go about approaching that situation?
Gosh, we had to just go back to just really, you know, talking about and trying to walk the talk with our examples as a staff and everything of, you know, why our culture is what it is and why we do pretty much everything. I mean, we were in such teaching mode from July on. We've never had this much inexperience in our program. And another thing, Jim, was just the guys we had coming back, you know, weren't major. They were role players, essentially. And so we had to kind of teach them about being kind of the guys. So, listen, my assistants and the staff deserve a heck of a lot of credit. The guys deserve a credit. It's came together a lot quicker than I envisioned. Marcy can tell you that. I was fit to be tied in September and October watching this group and thinking about going on a four-month fishing sabbatical. But then we ended up sticking it out, and they've done great. Now, we're still a very much a work in progress, and we're low on numbers. Our depth has really, really been challenged this year. But it's been a fun group, man. They're teachable, coachable. We move the ball really, really well. I think up until this weekend, we had the number one offense in America, and that's just based on us kind of sharing it and taking the right shots at the right time.
Talking to Mark Few, you know, Mark, you mentioned the culture. And as always, I know you're going to point to the players in the program and how the culture gets passed down from the older players to the younger players. But if you as the head coach ever let go of the rope, and that's the message, right? Never let go of the rope. If you do so as the head coach, it sends the message to the players that they can let go of the rope. So how do you personally stay sharp and with a grip on that rope year in and year out and day in and day out?
I love doing what I'm doing, and it helps that over all these years, you know, what we've been doing has been reinforced, you know, with a lot of winning, and it's been successful. So, you know, you kind of understand that, but we're always changing. My staff has been here a long time. Tommy Lloyd's a terrific, you know, lead assistant. Brian Michelson played for me, has been coaching with me forever. And so we're always tinkering things and changing things and moving on. I mean, we've just changed so drastically over, if you go back 20 years, of our approach offensively, defensively, and we kind of tweak it every year. And then I'll tell you another thing that's really helped me is it's been such a positive force in my professional development is the USA basketball, to be able to go and just watch and learn and observe, you know, from Coach K to Pop to, you know, Steve Kerr and Jay Wright and Billy Donovan. And it's just been an unbelievable experience, you know, kind of getting that little professional hit and development in the summers. It kind of challenges you to go back and change some things. I worked with Jeff Van Gundy this summer. What a phenomenal guy he is. I mean, sharp, and just knows basketball inside and out, and just a funny, great communicator, and a heck of a coach. So that's really helped me also kind of moving along.
Mark, I was going to say, what's that like? I mean, when you get with the best and the brightest and the most motivated and the most driven and the most determined guys, absolute alphas, and you get them all in one room, what's that like when you guys get together?
It's really cool. I mean, it's the reason they're so good is I think, you know, I mean, I can see they're all very humble, and not only are they knowledgeable, but they also, you know, there's a lot of sharing that goes on and a lot of asking, well, how do you guys do that? What would you approach on this ball screen or this or that? So it's great because I think the one thing that probably people don't understand when you're coaching and, you know, you have your own team, whether it's, you know, Pop or Coach K or Jay Wright or myself or anybody, we never get to go out and watch anybody else practice because we're so busy with our own stuff. So, you know, when you do, like I remember my first time doing it, I was on staff with Billy Donovan just to watch to see how he organizes his practice and his terminology and some of the things he does, even how he communicates and all that. It was great. It motivated me to get back home and you know, to be better at some of those things. And so it's very much like that. There's really a lot of sharing. I know there's no egos, and it just reaffirms to me just how many really, really, really good people there are in the coaching business.
Talking to Gonzaga head coach Mark Few, they are top ranked right now. You know, Mark, you mentioned culture and you mentioned family. There's this great story from the Final Four back in 2017 when you surprised your team by having nearly 100 former players come in before the semifinal against South Carolina. There was a highlight reel from their days as players. Then the current players were hugging on these guys, shaking their hands. When you think back on that and the fact that where these guys are now, you know, jobs, fathers, families, their own responsibilities, and they took out the time to come back and support you and the team in numbers, what does that feel like and mean to you?
Oh, Jim, like easily probably the most powerful experience, you know, looking back that I've felt at Gonzaga. I mean, I was kind of keeping myself to the back of the room, hiding some tears, you know, just watching. I mean, we got guys back, you know, even farther than, you know, obviously Stocks was in the room. And that when they lined up and, you know, well, first of all, my guys gave them a standing ovation, which I thought was just so cool. And then when they lined up and they basically kind of escorted our guys out of the film room, you know, and that was it. They, you know, the guys were going to bed before the first Final Four game in history. It was just a spectacular, really a moment I'll remember for the rest of my life. And it's really what makes this place so special, man. There really is a family, and it really is a really, really strong culture that we're, you know, very protective of. But it's some, you know, that, yeah, a lot of guys change jobs and bounce around and all that, and they miss out on that, you know, because, I mean, this is my kind of generation of guys that came through here, and the connectivity that I have to them and all that is probably the greatest aspect of this whole job.
Yeah, it's so funny, Mark. Like, I remember you and I have been doing this for so long. I can remember early on when it was my job to ask you, hey, Mark, what about those other opportunities? And then I hit a phase, Mark, where I felt badly about asking you about the other opportunities, but I still felt it was like my job. And then I finally reached a point where, like, I don't need to ask anymore. I already know the answer, and he's pretty much demonstrated exactly what the answer is, which brings me to this. And your AD, Mike Roth, talks about the program going to 21 straight NCAA tournaments, and that's never been done before by a program of that size. Quote, it's one thing to catch lightning in a bottle. It's another thing to keep it going for 21 straight years. Look, again, I know you'll never make it about you, Mark, but how much pride is there in the role that you've played in this level of sustained excellence right where you are?
I mean, it means everything to me. I mean, I've you know, essentially spent my whole adult life kind of working in this program, but I'd never really just sit down and think about, you know, how that affects me. You know, the one thing, I'm kind of a forward, it's always next play, next game, next recruiting class, next, and how can we get better? How can we grow? You know, what, even around here, facilities, everything. And I hope one day I'll be able to kind of sit back and you know, look back on it all. But I mean, I don't know if it's a gift or a curse, but I'm always kind of just looking forward, and I think most coaches are like that. But I would say, you know, you mentioned Mike. I mean, again, when you look at all the changes and everything and people jumping and people going here and there and in all athletic departments, I've been fortunate enough to work for the same guy, you know, my entire tenure here. And I think that's a huge part of, you know, why we've been able to remain so relevant and successful.
He is the head basketball coach at Gonzaga. They are 16-1. They're number one in both polls. Next up, they've got San Diego on Thursday. Mark, it goes without saying, so I'll say it anyway. I appreciate the friendship and the relationship. Happy New Year. Great to have you back. And I know we'll do it again before the end of the season.
Yeah, you got it. I always enjoy coming on with you.
John in Philly. It's good to have you, John. How are you?
Jim, it wasn't the greatest weekend for Philly fan, I can tell you.
Right, no doubt.
But what I can tell you is, whatever the outcome was of our season, it was worth watching Jerry Jones slink around in his box and wringing his hands, not knowing what he was going to be able to do for the rest of the season off the time that he isn't with his people. What a mess. And, Jim, I finally figured out what the problem is with Rick in Buffalo. He's constipated. It's not a monkey on his back like we had here in Philly until we got that Super Bowl. But what I can tell you is he's got a 400-pound gorilla stuck in his guts that he can't get out, and he's trying and trying and trying, and all he does is belch that gas while he's on your show with you. I'm out.
Oh, man. You know what? Rack him. Nice job, John. Larry in Houston. It's good to have you, Larry. How are you?
Hey, we're doing pretty good down here, Jim. Thank you very much. You know, like you alluded to earlier, it didn't look too good when the Texans were down by 16. An interesting stat that Coach O'Brien had never come back. He's 0-22 when down, trailing at least by 16 points. So,
right.
Like you said earlier, also, you know, Deshaun went Deshaun and did what he does, and you know, doing his Houdini tricks, and it was great. So it was an exciting win, and J.J. Watt is a huge part of that too. I mean, he is. You know, you would think you don't have to motivate those guys because they're all professionals and they're in their biggest game of their life, most of them. But just having JJ there, just absolutely huge. But what I wanted to share with you, Jim, real quick, was just a quick story about my son, Ethan, who is about the same age as your son, Jake. And cause I remember I've been a longtime listener. I've been listening to the show since Jake was born, right? And I got to tell you that Ethan is a big sports fan. We're Houston homers here. We love all the teams. We've got some ties with the Astros, and we love the Rockets and all of them, right? So we're homers. And Ethan, you know, when he started listening to you when he was a kid, he's like, I don't like that guy. He sounds so angry. You know, what's the deal? But I told him over the years, I go, Ethan, he's an acquired taste. I said, it's intelligent sports talk, and it's other than sports talk, too. That's really the fun part. But so Ethan was diagnosed with leukemia 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago now. And super strong 16-year-old and a nationally ranked motocross rider and also played football, you know, so he's not just was a one sport guy, you know, he's pretty athletic and balanced, but so he's diagnosed and immediately started doing treatment and he did a make a wish. By the way, quick update, Ethan's in remission. He's doing fantastic.
Great.
Great. Part of the deal was, thank you. Part of the deal was he wanted to, he had a make a wish and all he wanted to do was catch a pass from Deshaun Watson. So what he ended up doing was, they picked us up, you know, after months of coordinating it and getting it ready. Make-A-Wish comes and tells us what day it is and everything. And come pick us up, take us down to NRG in the limo. And we just thought it was going to be Ethan playing catch with Deshaun. We didn't know that the training camp was going on and everything. And we get down there. The next thing you know, as soon as he gets there, he's thrown into a live remote radio show with the local guys down there. And he killed it. It was amazing. In fact, the producer comes up to us afterwards and says, here's my card. Come down to the studio any time, you know? And then he goes through the whole thing and does his catches with Deshaun and does some touchdown moves. And then he goes into the press conference with Deshaun and killed it again. In fact, Deshaun says, this day was more for me than it was for Ethan. And Ethan inspired me. And it was just amazing. And the organization is awesome. You know, we're going to root for them, win or lose. And we hope they go up there to KC and they're able to, you know, be the underdog again or be the underdog this time and beat them. They beat them earlier in the year, but we'll see what happens. But I just want to share this last thing, too. Well, two things. Ethan, because he, you know, he's 18 now, but he just got his car recently because it kind of detoured his driver's ed when he was about to get it before he was diagnosed. And one of the first things he said when he's got his car, he said, oh, I can listen to Rome by myself now.
Great.
So I wanted to share that. And then the last thing I want to share was as everything was over that day when he did the Make-A-Wish deal, we're leaving. And all the cameras are gone, everything. And one of the vice presidents of the Texas came up to Ethan. And he says, Ethan, I was so impressed by what you've gone through and how you've gone through this battle. But I've also impressed with how you worked at the press conference. He said, have you ever considered a career with the Texans? And Ethan said, well, you know, that'd be really nice someday, sir, but what I'd really like are some tickets to a game this year. And so there's my story about Ethan.
I love that. Hey, Larry, thank you so much. I appreciate you sharing that story. Ethan sounds like an amazing kid. And well done. Really well done. Larry in H-Town, save that call, Alvin.
Good night now!